So we've been doing a series on debt in America all week long. We've been focusing on personal debt and strategies for getting in and out of debt and ways of thinking about your finances that maybe are a little more intelligent than some of the choices made by even some of the most reputable banks in the United States. But today we're going to look at the narrative of debt in America as a story of a changing identity of America in the last two generations. Joining us is Kevin Phillips, author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Kevin Phillips, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, one of the things that I find so compelling about the things that you write about, particularly as regards the credit crisis and the financial meltdown, is how underlying this story of day-to-day market fluctuations is really a deeper story of how America's identity in the world has fundamentally changed over the last two generations. Can you remind us what that identity change is?
Well, we've become a culture of debt. The United States as a nation is the world's leading debtor nation now. If you go back to the period right after World War One, we began to be the world's leading creditor nation, but we've left that far behind. If you look at the period during which Alan Greenspan was heading the Federal Reserve from 1987 to 2006, what they call total credit market debt in the United States, that's the combined total of private and public debt, went from roughly $11 trillion up to the neighborhood of $45 trillion. I mean, that's quadrupling.
And that's what everybody owes. That's everybody, government, personal, everybody. That's what's owed.
Well, it's what's owed in the form of something that's tradable. It doesn't include something that would be a contract or sort of over-the-counter structured financial product.
Right, right. Now, it was just announced by the Treasury yesterday that China has passed Japan as the sort of top lender to the United States. We're told repeatedly that for some reason the spending of American consumers is the engine that drives the global economy. Yet if that money is coming from China, it seems as though, you know, the engine's in one place and the fuel tank is in another place. How do you get a car out of that?
Well, I think the problem is that the Chinese have the leverage at this point because they have been very shrewd as they've sold a lot of things to the United States. They've collected the money as opposed to just racing out and spending it on things, and they've got huge reserves. And basically, they have the wherewithal to squeeze us quite a bit so that it'd be very hard for us to cut off their access to this market. But the difficulty is that if you've got a country that has an awful lot of money sitting around, which China is described that way now, and you have a country like this that just keeps spending more than it takes in and encourages a culture of debt, at a certain point, you put your head in the noose.
And Kevin, does anyone know exactly how much money the U.S. owes China?
Well, it's not a question of how much money the United States owes China. It's how much we have borrowed, at least that's the description, when we sell them debt securities. And the debt securities they have of one variety or another, you've got about $1 trillion.
So let's talk a little bit about that noose that you kind of ominously, referred to a moment ago. There are people who wander around the streets of New York with sandwich boards shrieking about the deficit. There's the debt clock that supposedly obligates me to some crazy amount of money that myself and my children are going to have to pay off. You describe this sort of political noose of eroding power in the world if you borrow too much and are too much beholden to nations like China. What is the real life consequence to having your, head in this noose that you're talking about?
Well, if you go back and you look historically at what happened to previous leading world economic powers, generally speaking, having too much debt was always a major part of their downfall. It was often linked to being too extended in terms of overseas military and political commitment. But to get as far out on a ledge as we are probably means you can never really get back. History doesn't let you sort of, walk back and then take the scene over again. And I realize that sounds like a horrible thing to say, but basically what it means is we're going to have to pay the piper. And unfortunately, paying the piper seems to take the form of circumstances like we've seen in the last 10 weeks, where basically your financial system comes unglued because people are just figuring out that, A, they don't know exactly what's in parts of it, and, B, the banks don't know either, and, C, the government can't get its act together. And the combination of all these things now is writ large across the horizon, and in stock market problems, in retirement accounts, in pension funds, in crumbling university endowments. These are chickens coming home to roost.
Although we still have the biggest chicken coop in the world in terms of the economy, and our economy is the largest in the world by a fairly substantial margin. I guess the question is there a bellwether in terms of these wealth funds like China and Japan and in Saudi Arabia? Is there a moment where they go, you know what, I'm not going to loan you any more money? Is there some sort of cross the Rubicon kind of landmark event that we should watch for between now and, you know, the next president taking office two terms away from now?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think there's a single landmark event that's likely to occur. The way these things usually work is that nobody makes any announcement that they're not going to buy American Treasury debt anymore, or that they're going to start putting together gold reserves and taking a number of other measures. They just do it quietly, and then some crisis comes up where you think that you're still able to do what you did a year or two ago, and lo and behold, you're not.
Wow.
Nobody blows a trumpet and says, hey, we're tired of you.
Well, let's change the subject, Kevin. Do you pay the minimums on your credit card bills?
Just to get personal.
How do you handle your own debt?
I pay the bill.
You pay the bill.
And I'm an old man. My parents were Depression people, and I never learned to do it the other way.
And you own your own house?
Correct.
All right. Well, Kevin Phillips, sitting pretty there in Connecticut. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Yes, Kevin Phillips pays his bills, Adora.
So Kevin Phillips helped us out with a bit of advice, and now we're asking for your help. We want your advice. What's the best way to lower debt?
My credit card statement has not been arriving. I've called the bank several times asking them for the statement, because if you're not vigilant, the deadline passes and you don't make your payment on a timely basis, they charge a late fee and a finance charge. We as Americans have to learn to complain more to the state banking authority and the federal banking authority so that all these banks can be penalized.
That's one strategy to get back at all the credit card companies. Here's another. Susan from Brooklyn says, my husband and I are making our last payment tomorrow on our last debt. We have paid off $128,000 in the past 30 months. The secret? The dreaded budget and lots of overtime and learning to tell yourself no. What are your ideas? What are your tips and tricks for getting rid of debt? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Strategies for financial discipline. I love that. Tell yourself no and learn to complain more. I really like that. If you missed anything today, subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And, of course, your debt stories all this week are on our website, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.